May it please the Court. This case concerns the transferability of a non-exclusive trademark license agreement. As this Court held just last term in 2011, it is the universal default rule in the United States that trademark license agreements are not transferable unless the agreement includes a provision that specifically grants the licensee the power to transfer the agreement. In this case, the written agreement goes the default rule 3 or 4 times better. It said the license agreement is personal to the licensee. It said the license agreement cannot be assigned, sublicensed, encumbered, or otherwise transferred by the licensee. It said any attempt to do any of these things shall be void ab initio. And it said none of the provisions of this agreement may be waived or modified except by a written agreement signed by both parties. This was a complex 43-page written agreement prepared by the plaintiffs. It was prepared with sophisticated counsel, and these terms very clearly and obviously were designed to provide and did provide for an ironclad contract in which the only contractor to them was the named licensee, which was a Greek corporation by the name of Elmex Sport S.A.
This pretty case, simple way for you to avoid jurisdiction here is to tell the other party, well, we just had a merger. We got a new name. That didn't change much except our name. It doesn't mean a damn thing, but we'd like you to sign this paper that says you approve of it, and then hope they don't sign the paper within a couple of weeks or something, whatever you give them. The contract doesn't say how soon they have to sign the thing, I gather, does it?
Your Honor, the contract flatly precludes.
And after that happens, you can just walk away and say, well, we'll go to Greece and try the problem if you have any.
Your Honor, there was no written agreement between these parties for the first 6 months of 2010. And whether it was intended or not intended, the written terms of the agreement resulted in a situation in which, to the extent that there was a relationship between the plaintiffs and the named defendant in this case, it was a non-contractual relationship. And it's not that they don't have remedies. They are, as I stand here before you, aggressively pursuing a parallel action in Greece, in Athens, against duty-free shops. And one of the things I'll come to in my rebuttal is the extraordinary situation our client faces itself, in which it's been summoned to appear in a court in September, and the district judge here has ordered that it will be at risk of contempt if it actually responds to the summons and stands up in court and expresses opposition to the plaintiff.
What exactly did the district judge say you could or could not do in the Greek litigation?
In the anti-suit injunction, as it was styled, the district court did not seem to understand that the plaintiffs were seeking not merely a compelled withdrawal of a parallel action in Greece, but were actually apparently asking the judge.
Excuse me, but yes. What is it that you want to do in Greece that you believe the injunction prevents you from doing?
According to the order on denial of stay, up in court.
I'm asking you,
yes,
what you want to be able to say in a Greek court in defense of the Greek action that you believe the district court's order prevents you from doing.
Showing up and presenting defenses to their claim.
That's anything.
Anything. That's what the district judge said in his order, that the defendant. In fact, there is pending in the trial court right now a motion for sanctions because on February the 17th, in their case, duty-free shops appeared in the Greek court and made arguments, what they considered were valid arguments, why under Greek and international law the district court's interlocutory ruling was not a judgment, and it was premature to be seeking recognition in Greece of an interlocutory ruling of a district judge. And it wasn't until after that hearing had been held that Judge Adelman, in his order, it's I believe it's the supplemental appendix page on page SA-37, he says, while the injunction does prohibit defendant from opposing plaintiff's efforts to enforce in Greece the preliminary injunction I issued, these efforts cannot cause meaningful harm to the defendant. Nothing that the district judge said purported to find that there would be irreparable harm or that there was any basis in equity or any authority to issue an order that a foreign national cannot appear in its own court in defending an action. It is our belief that this is the first time in the history of the country that an anti-defense injunction has been issued, apparently to try to overcome the rule that injunctions inherently are not final, and therefore, as the Supreme Court noted in the Medin case in 2008, historically it's only been money judgments that are enforceable in a different state. Injunctions are always subject to revision, and generally, therefore, neither a United States court nor a foreign court is required to recognize an inherently changeable injunction of a U.S. court. So what we have here, then, is a situation in which the existence of the parallel action by the plaintiffs underscores why it's very unusual for the defendant here to be the contract to be stretched to impose obligations on a non-signatory, a non-named party, to litigate in the United States whether personal property, tangible personal property it owns, and was imported into Greece, and which it contends is its property, which it is genuine, lawfully right to sell in Greece, should be determined in a U.S. court.
Mr. Dabney,
yes.
You've relied heavily on the contract issues on Professor White's affidavit. Did Professor White see the documents that defendant sent dated January 20th, 2011, announcing the merger? And did he see your letter of July 28, 2011, accusing Harley-Davidson of wrongfully repudiating the contract you're now arguing is void?
I'm certain he saw that the announcement letter in January. I cannot recall right now whether he saw the July 28 letter, but I believe that he did.
Does his affidavit discuss those?
I believe his affidavit, I don't recall whether his affidavit
I don't think it does.
Those at
well,
all.
Let me ask you about those documents. It's an interesting theory about comparing paragraphs 10 and 14 and so on. But you've tried to suggest in your reply brief that the January 20th announcement that says nothing's changing, our contracts are still in place, was a, quote, obvious overgeneralization. But it seems to be a pretty clear invitation to rely upon the continued validity of the contract, isn't it?
I would say it is a legal conclusion that is, as I say, it is an overgeneralization.
And with respect to your own letter of July 28th, where you say that we consider that your client has wrongfully repudiated the license agreement,
mm-hmm.
How is that consistent with the position you're taking now?
The position is that there was an informal license agreement in place between the parties.
With a capital L, capital A? Is that what... Come on.
There was not...
You were... a wrongful repudiation. Is that the theory? A wrongful repudiation of an agreement that under your current theory would have been an informal agreement that either side could have walked away from at any point, right? Come on.
The business relationship they had
That's where your position takes you, right?
The position that we're taking under the contract, there was an informal license agreement. That is the position, yes. And the position is that... as I understand, under Greek civil law, There may be rights and remedies that flow from the circumstances that led to the abrupt termination.
And we're supposed and those to believe that that's what you were referring to in your letter of July 28th?
I don't believe my letter refers specifically to any specific license agreement.
Capital L, capital A.
That's right.
Okay. That's the way lawyers usually refer to a specific agreement.
There was exchange of correspondence. They were certainly referring. They were certainly taking the position that there was a license agreement in place. There is obviously a major dispute between the parties whether there is a written license agreement in place. And certainly by that time, the parties' business relationship had been completely severed. I don't think that it is correct. That under applicable Michigan law, Michigan is as textualist a state as exists in the United States in terms of what the rights and obligations flowing from the written contract are. There has been not any serious defense put forward that there is a categorical exclusion from the terms of this agreement for transfers that are affected by means of merger transactions. And by that time, the parties were in litigation. Yes, to the extent that they are correct, which we say they are not correct, to the extent that they are correct in their assertion that there was a license agreement, it is the position that there was a repudiation. Yes.
Mr. Dabney, when did you personally learn the Greek action was going to be filed by your client?
Was going to be filed?
Yes.
I'm reluctant to answer that question, Your Honor.
Did you know it would be filed before it was filed?
I did.
All right. You've challenged Judge Adelman's findings of bad faith.
We have.
You knew before it was going to be filed that it was filed. You were before Judge Adelman or communicating with him on November 23rd and December 15th, right?
That is absolutely correct.
Did it occur to you in those occasions to tell Judge Adelman about the filing of the Greek action? Did you choose not to tell him?
It was a deliberate choice not to bring that up.
What's unreasonable about finding that deliberate choice was in bad faith?
Because as far as I believe, there was nothing bad faith about it. I was not involved in the prosecution of the Greek action. I was not counsel in the Greek action. The Greek action was being waged.
Did you think that was material information the judge ought to know about?
For what purpose?
For protecting his own jurisdiction.
I did not feel that the issue of the prosecution of the Greek action in Greece, in terms of the parties' rights and obligations in Greece,
which was aimed directly at nullifying the effect of the proceedings before Judge Adelman. Maybe right, maybe wrong, but you don't think he was entitled to know about it?
I'm not aware of an obligation that would have imposed that obligation on me, no, Your Honor.
Interesting. Okay.
I'm into my rebuttal time. If I could reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Yes, you may.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court. Good morning, Your Honors. David Kelly for Appalese Harley-Davidson Motor Company, Inc., and HD Michigan LLC. Your honors have determined, I think rather quickly, this case is about this no contract theory that is based solely on the licensee's merger with its own parent company, not even a third party, from its own parent company. And it's simply an after the fact attempt to try and avoid liability under this contract. It's an attempt to avoid this clear form selection clause that says that all disputes have to be decided in Wisconsin. And the judge here, Judge Adelman, made a number of findings in this case with respect to the defendant's conduct, including findings that Harley-Davidson was likely to succeed on its claim that the contract was breached in a number of different ways. The sale of the penny market goods to a discount grocery store in Germany, the failure to pay royalties, the failure to provide information that Harley-Davidson had a right to under the contract regarding what products defendant had sold, what products were being manufactured, and what products were in process. And it was very disingenuous of the defendants who refused to provide this information back in April, May, June timeframe. Harley-Davidson had suspended all approvals of products on April 14th. April 15th, the defendant acknowledged that and said it will act accordingly. And then Harley-Davidson terminated the agreement April 22nd. And then 3 months later...
Is that based on the merger itself?
The termination? Yeah. No, the termination was based on the defendant's conduct that I've just described.
You do have a provision to terminate on the basis of merger, too, do you not?
Yes, we have the option.
Option.
But Harley did not exercise that option. And these AW goods that defendants sent us a letter asking us to approve samples in July 22nd of 2011, this is some 3 months after the agreement was terminated, some 3 months after defendant was told that no product approvals would be forthcoming, and yet they manufactured these goods and then sprung them on Harley-Davidson at the last second. Judge Adelman found that that was likely a breach as well as unreasonable. And then the Greek action, which we've discussed, not only did Judge Adelman find that defendant acted in bad faith in not disclosing to the U.S. court this Greek action, but also in not disclosing the U.S. action or the U.S. injunction that was pending to the Greek court. And with respect to the argument that it was not a material omission in not telling Judge Adelman about the Greek action, I think that's just very wrong. It's just plain wrong for the simple reason that all of defendants' briefs in this case to dissolve the TRO, to fight against the preliminary injunction, the focal point of their case are these AW goods that never got approved. And they said this case is all about the AW goods. Well, what was their injunction they obtained in Greece? The injunction they obtained in Greece was for Harley-Davidson to be enjoined from interfering with the sale of these AW goods. The same thing they were trying to get in the United States to lift the injunction against the AW goods. So it was a highly material omission to the district court.
Mr. Kelly, could you address the scope of the injunction against the Greek action? Because, frankly, I'm troubled by the idea that a U.S. court would tell a party, in essence, it has to remain mute in a foreign court.
Well, there's two petitions that Harley-Davidson filed. It's important to distinguish between two of them. One petition Harley-Davidson filed was simply to enforce the preliminary injunction decision of Judge Adelman. The second action that Harley-Davidson filed was, again, a petition, and this was a petition to dissolve the provisional injunction that defendant had obtained against Harley-Davidson in Greece, which, by the way, the defendant did not dismiss that provisional order against Harley-Davidson within the 10 days provided in the anti-suit injunction. But getting back to the order that I think the matter that Your Honor is talking about, quite simply, it was a petition to enforce the U.S. preliminary injunction. Now, the contract, 16.2, already provides that any decrees of the district court in the U.S. in Wisconsin would be binding on the defendant worldwide as a matter of contract law. And so Harley-Davidson readily assumed that defendant would comply with this injunction. But once defendant did not
comply... It's an optimistic assumption under the circumstances.
Perhaps, but not having been told about it, had we been told about it, we would have obviously taken a different approach. But the point is that the only thing that Harley sought was to enforce its preliminary injunction in Greece. It did not have a separate action, which I think is important.
I think what you were trying to do in the Greek action, but what do you think would and would not be prohibited for the defendant, Hellenic Duty Free Shops, in responding to those actions? Do they have to stay literally silent?
I think with respect to the injunction that they are contractually bound to follow, yes. Now, I would agree
literally
with you.
Literally silent.
Yes. Because it's really the flip side of the U.S. case. It's also the flip side of the injunction that that the defendant obtained against Harley Davidson. Now, it would be a completely different situation, I would agree, if Harley was asserting affirmative claims, you know, for infringement under Greek law, for different remedies under Greek law, and I would agree it would be an unreasonable interpretation for the defendant not to be able to defend against those claims. But this is simply an enforcement matter whereby Harley Davidson wants to get on record in the Greek court because of all these non-disclosures of defendant. We wanted to get on record the fact that there was this U.S. injunction and it should be followed nationwide or worldwide according to the party's contract.
Why not, in essence, allow the Greek courts to decide? They're a sovereign nation, sovereign courts. Why not decide, in essence, whether to give effect to a U.S. injunction? Make your arguments about the binding nature of the U.S. contract and the U.S. injunctions to the Greek courts.
Well, ultimately, that's what happened, Your Honor, because defendant show up at the hearing and argued against Harley Davidson's request for a provisional order to enforce its preliminary injunction in Greece, and the court granted Harley Davidson's request over defendant's objections.
So what's the status now in Greece?
The status in Greece is that there is a hearing, I believe, set for September for a permanent order with respect to Harley's petition to enforce the preliminary injunction in Greece. And there's certainly nothing stopping defendant here from seeking relief from the district court to modify or clarify that order with respect to what they can do at the hearing on the merits in September. The merger announcement, which we've talked about just a little bit, the characterization of that as an obvious generalization is pretty unreasonable. It was not something mass-mailed that Harley Davidson just received. This was, in fact, personally sent by email to the Harley Davidson person that managed the license relationship with defendant. And it's in the record at A728 and A729. And the representative defendant said, "Dear Susan, hope you had a safe trip home. I also wish to thank you for all your assistance and positive feedback on our new collection." So here, in addition to sending this merger notice, the representative of defendant is also talking about new projects that they're working on, which makes sense given that business continued as usual for many months. And then the representative defendant said, "Please find attached the official notice about the merger." Now, the merger notice.
This is a question of contract interpretation that's governed by Michigan law under this contract, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
And we have this affidavit of this professor who presumably is very knowledgeable about Michigan law interpreting it in a contrary way, right? And what specifically is incorrect about his analysis?
There are a number of things incorrect about his analysis, and he wouldn't be the first professor to not have his testimony accepted in a case. But before we talk about the professor's testimony, I think it's important to note that defendant objected to the introduction of that testimony for purposes of this appeal because it was not in the record. It was filed after the record was closed for these appeals, and Harley Davidson objected to the inclusion of that in their brief. But Professor White's analysis is all wrong for several reasons. First, Section 10.1AV, which governs the right to terminate for an assignment, is very distinct from 10.1C(i), which governs Harley Davidson's right to terminate for a merger. And to look at those two provisions is it's very important because there's two different things going on in those provisions. In 10.1AV, it's an attempt to assign the license agreement or the rights thereunder. So the focus of 101AV, which mirrors the assignment provision of 14, is on assigning the agreement. Then there's a separate provision, 101CI, which talks about not only any merger, but any merger, consolidation, acquisition, or change of ownership, control, or management involving licensee. So 10.1CI is geared towards things that happen with the licensee, whereas with 101AV, it's geared toward assignment of the agreement. They're two very different things, and the defendant's interpretation would violate a number of rules of construction, contract construction under Michigan law and probably every other state's law, that you need to look at the contract as a whole. You need to give the words plain meaning, and you need to not render provision superfluous. The defendant's interpretation would render the whole merger termination provision completely superfluous. And these red herrings that they throw out, well, the agreement is personal. Well, whether it's personal does not control the situation here. Yes, many intellectual property licenses may be personal, and the general rule may be that they're non-assignable if there's no other language in the agreement addressing assignment. But here we have separate provisions addressing assignment and addressing merger, and they're very distinct terms.
Counsel, I asked a question of your opponent whether the merger provision was any part of the basis for termination, and he indicated it was not. Right.
It was not. That's right. And I believe Your Honor also made the point that there's no time restriction on the consent to be given if there was an assignment.
Interests me.
Yes. And there is no time limit for giving that consent, just like there's no time limit.
Of non-assent by silence.
Yes. And certainly, based on the way this case has been litigated, Harley-Davidson certainly consented to the assignment of the agreement, if it was an assignment under Section 14, by its conduct in this case. Defendant also does not address...
conduct apparently doesn't count, according to your opponent.
No. There's lots of other conduct besides the merger notice. And the merger notice, as I mentioned, was very detailed. The merger notice said that Hellenic acts as, quote, full successor of Elmec, full successor, and that, quote, all the contracts Elmec has entered into remain valid. They also go on to say that the shareholders and management of Elmec are the same with Hellenic. They also say, quote, this merger does not alter the ownership structure and or the management of our company. And it also goes on to say it shall not affect the business relationships between our two companies. I've only read probably four sentences from this full-page notice that is anything but general.
Well, what does it affect? We know it doesn't affect, but is there anything specified as to what it affects?
No. No, there's certainly nothing in that notice that would lead Harley-Davidson to believe that this contract was somehow automatically terminated because there was an assignment of the agreement and no consent provided. To the contrary, this was clearly an inducement to Harley-Davidson to rely on. Harley-Davidson, in fact, did rely on it by continuing to do business with the defendant, continuing to let defendant use its world-famous trademarks, all to its prejudice, as we have seen. And there's more conduct besides just the merger notice and Mr. Dabney's July 28th letter. There's doing business with each other in between that, taking orders, defendant taking orders for Harley-Davidson products. Defendant writing to Harley-Davidson and say, don't send invoices to this old address. Send them to these new contact details that we had in our merger. Everything that defendant did gave all indications that business was usual under this contract until we got to this case in October. And it's clear that it's an after-the-fact, hyper-technical argument to try and avoid the jurisdiction of the Wisconsin court and the decisions that many unfavorable decisions that have come down, and to try and get the case into Greece. The reference to the informal license in the first 6 months of 2010 is completely irrelevant. All the conduct that took place here was in the first 6 months of 2011, not 2010. And even if defendants' informal license theory had any validity, which it does not, the basic principles of contract law would be that the parties would continue to operate under the agreement that was most recently in existence until and unless they entered into a new agreement. So even under the informal license, which is essentially an implied license, they would still be bound by the terms of the contract.
Mr. Kelly, I don't know if we're going to get into these issues or not. Obviously, you have suggested that we not get into some of the procedural issues involving the issuance of the TRO and its extensions. But I'd be grateful if you could address what looks like a gap between issuance of the TRO, its expiration, and renewal. Specifically, if I'm doing the math right, October 4th was the 28th day after issuance of the original TRO.
That's correct, Your Honor.
The initial extension for the second 14 days had said, in essence, pending service process under the Hague Convention. You got that service actually, you didn't know it, but before the extension was granted. And proof of service is then filed on October 7th, I believe.
That's correct.
And so one could argue by its terms at that point the TRO had expired. And then 10 days later, the district court on the 17th says we're going to leave it in place pending the preliminary injunction hearing. That 10-day gap troubles me a little bit, and I'd be say if you could address that.
Yes. Two responses to that, Your Honor. First is there are a number of courts that have extended TROs beyond the 28 days or then 20-day limit where it was necessary to get to a preliminary injunction hearing, whether it was discovery or scheduling or other types of situations. We could not locate a Seventh Circuit case on that, but there's a First Circuit case, a number of district courts, all of which Judge Adelman thoroughly discussed and addressed in his opinion. So, number one, we have that case law. In particular, there's the All Metals Court decision from Eastern District of Michigan. Granted, it's a district court, but it faced the same exact situation here. It had a German defendant who refused to accept service of process and insisted on being serviced under the Hague Convention, and the court said, well, look, if we limit it to the 28 days of Rule 65, there's no way we can get to the preliminary injunction hearing because of the time it takes to serve under the Hague, and if we did that, it would render Rule 65 inoperable against foreign companies. So under those circumstances, the All Metals Court, which I believe made a very sound and reasonable decision for good cause, just like you have to have good cause to extend for the second 14 days, they found good cause to do that. Now, the second thing we have here, as Your Honor pointed out, is that the 28 days from the September 6th TRO expired on October 4th. Of course, it was extended before that, but technically it expired on October 4th. On that day, October 4th, defendant filed its answer and made an appearance. And that's how Farley Davidson learned for the first time that defendant had actually been served. Defendant had been served 21 days before that, but waited to the last day to file their answer, which is certainly their right, but is perhaps more than a coincidence given the timing issues. But be that as it may, the fact that service was made on September 13th, that defendant made an appearance, advised the court that it was served, we think that that arguably could automatically convert the TRO into a preliminary injunction in the event this court did not adopt what other courts have done and extend the 28 days for good cause. And such a ruling would be consistent with this court's decisions in several cases, such as commodity futures and U.S. versus Board of Education of Chicago, which holds generally that any TRO that is more than 28 days is automatically appealable as a preliminary injunction. Now, it didn't say it automatically was a preliminary injunction, but the rationale, we believe, would apply the same as an alternative basis. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. How much time? 1.5 minutes, counsel.
With regard to the Rule 65 issues in this case, the defendant in this case sharply disputes the factual basis of the plaintiff's claims. The TRO was issued before the defendant had been served with process. The extension of the TRO for first 62 days without an evidentiary hearing is inconsistent with this court's precedents. And by the time of the December 15 hearing, the values that would have been sought to be defended at that hearing had already been lost and bonded against to the extent of $1.8 million, and we had already appealed to this court. There was no way, other than commencing the Greek action, that DFS could have done anything to try to salvage its position without potentially jeopardizing its position, which it respectfully presses to this court, that notwithstanding all of the realism-type arguments that have been put forward under Michigan law, this contract that they sued on does not impose any obligations. Professor White is correct, and that under the textualist approach to statutory interpretation and contract interpretation that the Michigan Supreme Court has adopted, the contract is controlling, and the contract simply does not impose obligations to consent to jurisdiction in this case. We respectfully request that the district court's orders be vacated and that the case be dismissed for lack of personal jurisdiction. Thank you,
Mr. Dabney. Thanks again to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.